Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Benjamin Butler. I'm an assistant state public defender, and I represent the appellant, Scott Klund. This court must reverse Mr. Klund's conviction because an actually biased person sat on his jury and or because he received constitutionally ineffective assistance of counsel. I'd like to start with the juror issue, if I may. Parties agree that juror JT expressed an actual bias in favor of law enforcement during jury selection. And I'd like to linger there for a second because I think it's important and colors the rest of the discussion to talk about just what that means. The Sixth Amendment, of course, guarantees to a defendant the right to an impartial jury. That is the backbone of our legal system. The Supreme Court in the Brown case said that the impartiality of the juror goes to the very integrity of the legal system. And so when someone like JT expresses an actual bias, in this case saying unequivocally that he would credit police officer testimony over that of other witnesses just because of their job, and when I say said, I mean he said it in his questionnaire, that goes to the very integrity of our legal system. At least four of JT's relatives are law enforcement officers, including his former son-in-law, who he sees quite often when the gentleman picks up the grandchildren, JT's grandchildren. He thinks that gentleman has good credibility. I'm sure he does. And he supports law enforcement and thinks they have a very difficult job, as many people, of course, do. But he takes that one step further, JT does, to then say he would be inclined to credit their testimony over other witnesses simply because of their job. That actual bias should disqualify JT from sitting on the jury unless a very high bar can be overcome. And that is that the juror must swear he could set aside his opinion, any opinion he might hold, and decide the case based only on the evidence. I'm paraphrasing the Minnesota Supreme Court in Logan, just quoting a U.S. Supreme Court decision.
Isn't that what he said? I mean, the judge found that he had been rehabilitated, and towards the end of the questioning mm-hmm. of this juror, the judge said, okay, the questionnaire asked, and I asked this morning, all attorneys asked you, and I just want to make sure, will you treat the police either better or worse just because they're police officers, or will you treat them like any other witness? And he said, I will treat them like any other witness. And the court later found that it was clear when he denied the request to mm-hmm. strike him. So why isn't that rehabilitation?
Two reasons, Your Honor. First, I agree with something in respondent's brief, and that's at page 18 of respondent's brief. They say, to decide this, you must consider the totality of the juror's question and answer session, mm-hmm. not just single questions and single answers. So in order to decide whether the juror has been adequately rehabilitated, the court has to look at every question and answer he gave, not just that one that came at the very end. Number two, well, let me continue with that, because the vast majority of those question and answers are equivocal at best. The first attempt at rehabilitating him, which was at page 198 to 99, the court says, if I instructed you to treat all witnesses the same, would you do that? And JT says, yes, I would, or sure. But the court never instructed JT or any other juror to treat all witnesses the same. The court in its jury instructions, final jury instructions, told the jury that they were the sole evaluators of credibility and that there were no, that's the court's words, no hard and fast rules in guiding them in that job. They could do it however they wanted to. And so not only did the court not instruct JT to treat all witnesses the same, the court gave JT the exact opposite impression, that he could do whatever he wanted when evaluating witness credibility. And of course, in most cases, that's true. But the problem here is we're dealing with an actual bias. And so what the court should have told or could have told JT is, except you, of course, may not rely on your actual bias. You've promised to set aside your actual bias, and you may not credit the testimony of police officers over other witnesses just because of their job. If the court had done that, perhaps that would be different, but that's not what happened here. The second attempt at page 281 to 82, which is with defense. 281 to 82, Your Honor.
Thank you.
is the sort of second back and forth with JT. This one is with defense counsel about this issue. And JT repeatedly says things like, it would be, I hope I would do it differently. I can't say for certain. And the lawyer says, why? Why is this such a big deal for you? And he says, because I respect law enforcement and I support their jobs. None of that is rehabilitation. The third attempt is on page 333. Is two very long leading questions from the prosecutor. One is that, you understand, sir, that in this court, in any court of law, every witness is entitled to the same degree of deference, right? Now, that is a classic leading question. Of course he's going to say yes, and he does. And then finally, at the very end, page 335, is the single question and answer that Your Honor referenced. If you look at that as a totality, what you see there is a person who has expressed an honest bias. JT's being honest. I have no beef with him personally. He's telling his opinion. He's then trying to be honest when he's trying to say, through almost all of the questioning, you know, I'll do my best, but I don't know. This is how I feel. I have a basis for how I feel. It's a reasonable basis for how I feel. You tell me, I don't know, I'll do my best, but we'll see what happens.
Counsel, you're giving inflections that, of course, none of us know about because none of us were there. And doesn't this court treat the district court's finding of rehabilitation as a credibility finding?
You're right, Your Honor. I am giving inflections, but you don't need the inflections. You can read the words on the paper.
But the district court had more than the words. And you know, practicing in this area, as we know, that oftentimes the words don't convey everything that a witness is saying by body language, by inflection, by everything else. And again, I'll ask you, don't we give deference to the district court in terms of the finding of rehabilitation?
You certainly give deference to the district court. It is an abuse of discretion standard. I agree with that. I disagree that it is ultimately a credibility decision.
Isn't there case law that suggests that?
No, I think the case law suggests that it is. The reason it's discretionary is, you're right, the district court's there, can see the witnesses, can hear the inflection, et cetera. The district court here did not say anything about JT's inflection or voice inflection or anything else. The district court here said, first he said, well, the word I think so, the phrase I think so, or I think not, I don't have the exact quote in front of me, but I think not means no. And the Minnesota Supreme Court has rejected that. In Fraga, the district court there, just like the district court here, sat, heard the witness testify, heard the witness's voice inflections, and when the witness said, I'll try my best, I think I can be fair, I'll give it my best shot, the district court credited that and said, okay, this juror can sit. And the Supreme Court said, that's an abuse of discretion. Because those words, I don't think so, I'll try, conditional words, phrases like that, are just that. They're conditional. They're not unconditional. And the Supreme Court in Fraga and Logan and this court in Reese never said, well, the juror said he could try, but what the district court must have thought that the juror, by her voice inflection, must have meant, I really will. That's not part of the test here.
But then what do we do with the language from, I feel like, Wheel of Fortune, I'll buy a vowel.
Yes.
Pertine or how?
Pertine. Yeah. Pertine.
Where they say, because the district court, and this is a quote from the Supreme Court, is in the best position to observe and judge the demeanor of a prospective juror, we defer to that determination.
Sure. And I think, so two responses to that. First of all, of course, the juror in Pertine, the Supreme Court said the district court had erred in not granting the motion to strike that juror for cause, because that juror did not unequivocally say that. I believe that's also a juror who supports law enforcement. That juror did not unequivocally say he or she would set that aside. So even though the Supreme Court recognizes that the district court is in the best position and there is an abuse of discretion standard, in Pertine, the Supreme Court said there was an abuse of discretion. Because if you read the words that the juror said, the juror never said he or she would set aside the bias. So Pertine is a great example of a case in which you look at the words and you see what the juror actually said.
Except our juror did say, I will treat them like any other witness.
At the very end, that's a single question, sure. And so if I was, so let me come back to the credibility.
But it also wasn't The court didn't do a leading question to elicit that answer. It was
no, I agree. It was a yes or no question or an option A, option B question.
Right.
I agree with that.
Yeah.
I think that's true. I think it would be better if the court, instead of giving option A and option B, had just talked to the juror and said, tell me in your own words, not this at the end of a long series of questions where the juror's probably getting an idea of what everybody's looking for here, giving the juror option A, will you be unfair, or option B, will you be fair? And then the juror says, well, of course I'll be fair. What the Supreme Court says is that the juror has to swear to set aside any opinion. This juror never said he would set aside any opinion. The juror never even really acknowledged that there was a problem here. No one acknowledged that there was a problem here. The court never said to the juror, you know, that's an actual bias. You realize that's a real problem when you say you'd support law enforcement over other witnesses just because of their job. That renders you biased. Let's talk about that. Tell me about that. Tell me how you would set that aside or why.
The prosecutor at page 104 said, that's a concern, sir, and again, I mean no disrespect, but some of your answers to defense counsel seem a little more qualified than I think that they were looking for. You understand, sir, that in this court, in any court of law, every witness is entitled to the same degree of deference.
Sure, that comes from...
the leading question.
It says, sure, that is a tremendously leading question, and it comes from the prosecutor. It doesn't come from the judge. In addition, let's take that last question. The last question and answer. Non-leading, and the juror says yes. Same thing happened in Fraga. In Fraga, there's one unequivocal response to a question, yes. Buried with lots of equivocal responses. And the Supreme Court said, not good enough. Because you have to look at the totality of the questioning. Not just was there a single Q&A that was the right answer. But look at the overall questioning. And if you do that here, you'll see a juror who does not acknowledge his bias, who doesn't acknowledge there's anything wrong with it, doesn't say, yes, I acknowledge my bias, but I will set it aside. He answers an A or B question at the very end of this colloquy. And as in Fraga and as in Pertin, that's not good enough. Back to the credibility question, Your Honor. If the credibility comes into play where the juror gives a bunch of unequivocal answers, yes, I will be fair, and the defense attorney stands up and says, Judge, I don't believe him. He says he can be fair, but look at him. He's a crime victim, or his daughter was a crime victim, or you know, whatever. His background would indicate there's no way he could possibly be fair. So I'm moving to strike for cause. And the district court says, no, you know what? I heard him talk. I heard him say, yes, I believe him. I think he can be fair. Cause challenge denied. If that's what we were dealing with here, then we would be running headlong into a district court's credibility determination. The witness said yes, and I believe the witness. Here, this is different. We're not saying JT is lying at any point here. In fact, I think he's trying to be honest. Until he gets to the very end and he's put in this A box of A or B and he says A. But here you look at the totality of the questioning to determine whether the district court abused its discretion. And if the totality of the questioning, and I submit in this case it does, shows that the juror has not renounced the bias, then the juror shouldn't sit and the district court did abuse its discretion. I have 1 minute left. I wanted to touch very briefly on the ineffective assistance claim. That claim is all about prejudice. I think everybody agrees. Counsel was deficient. And the defendant here was prejudiced for two reasons. First, the jury spent the whole time in deliberations considering the wrong question. Detailed, fact-specific questions of whether the decedent and the other gentleman in the house were committing felony crimes. That never should have been in the jury room at all. And that's where they start. The self-defense defensive dwelling instruction says this is the first thing they have to do. And they never should have been doing it. Number two, we'll never know. We'll never know if the jury rejected Mr. Clune's account of events and found him guilty because they believed the state's witnesses, or whether the jury accepted Mr. Clune's account of events and found him guilty because even under his account, those two people weren't committing felonies in his dwelling. They just weren't. There's no, I don't think there's a question about that.
I have a question for you. In your brief, you say that the woman's backpack was in Klun's bedroom. And I looked through the testimony. I couldn't find that.
I'll find the sites for you in the record, Your Honor. Can I respond?
Yes.
I see I'm out of time. Yes, there is a backpack in Mr. Klun's bedroom that is not his, that I believe at least the circumstantial evidence would indicate is Ms. Rawls's backpack.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Because I know that the police didn't take all of the bags that were in the bedroom.
Yes, that's correct.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Assistant Ramsey County Attorney Peter Marker, representing respondent. I'll also touch on both issues to the extent I have time. I want to begin with the juror bias claim with some language from Fraga, because I think this really is a case about deference. Not all of these cases are so about deference, but this one is. And Fraga says, we give great deference to a district court's finding of fact regarding juror bias. Whether or not a juror has been rehabilitated has to be a finding of fact. And Judge Guthman made that finding here specifically. Now, on the question of abuse of discretion, I fully believe that this is one of those cases. And, of course, our case law tells us that not all the cases are like this, but this is one of those cases where the universe of Judge Guthman's discretion here would have certainly included either ruling, right? And so the universe of his discretion on this record would have included a strike for granting the strike for cause. But of course, it's my position that it also included denying the strike for cause on this record, because there are two things that are missing here from the cases that appellant relies on, where our courts, Minnesota Supreme Court, has found a trial court to have abused its discretion in denying a strike for cause. One is universal equivocation on the part of the juror. In the cases that appellant cites, you have either universal or near universal equivocation on the part of the juror. So we don't have that here. Here we have a situation where the juror is equivocating to a degree and then at times being unequivocal in response to questioning. And ultimately, the juror is unequivocal. That's why the trial court's ability to see and hear the juror in a case like this is so important. When Judge Guthman makes the finding specifically that that the juror was unequivocally, that the juror had been
Counsel,
rehabilitated.
I think, as I hear Mr. Butler's argument, what he's focusing on is the fact that the, to your point, whether this juror is equivocating or not, that there's really just the one answer where the juror in his own words says, I will treat them, police officers, like any other witness. So isn't that near equivocation? I mean, that's his argument. So I want to hear
Your Honor, that is certainly the ultimate and probably most important point of unequivocation on the part of the juror. But there are earlier points.
In his own words, where he says exactly the same thing? I thought it seemed as though most of the answers I read, and I'm sure I don't know this transcript as well as you do, he's constantly including caveats.
Well, I mean, he is responding to questions in response to the court. Is there any reason you wouldn't be able to do that, talking about treating police officers fairly? No.
Well, right, or there are leading questions, but I'm sure you're not relying on those, are you?
Well, I think you have to look at the whole record. I
mean, and that's what Mr. Butler says.
Right, you look at the whole record, and that's why I believe in this case that the universe of Judge Guthman's discretion here included either ruling, because he was able to evaluate the demeanor and the tone and the manner that the potential juror was answering these questions. And so when he, you know, when he says, you know, would you hold the testimony of any police officer above that of others simply because they are a police officer? He says, no, I don't think so. And now I'm adding my own inflection to that answer. But the point is, maybe he said it in a way that said, I don't think so.
I don't think you're going to get any disagreement given the comments from the court so far.
Right.
That is exactly the role of a trial judge, and I'm not suggesting otherwise. You said you had a second point. So
my second point.
Case law, that there are other instances in which appellate courts have carefully looked at.
Right. My first point was that there was not universal equivocation. My second point is that there is not the element of a deeper, more embedded bias here. Fraga is a case that appellant is relying on strongly to establish juror bias, but in that case, the juror had intimate familiarity with the facts. His mother-in-law, I think it's his mother-in-law, worked at the hospital where the murdered child was brought on the night of the murder. There had been a lot of family discussion around that fact. So there's this familiarity with the facts and bias that's potential bias that's stemming from that familiarity. He was aware that the defendant had gotten off in a previous trial, I'm paraphrasing, on a technicality or something like that. So as I note in my brief, I think that he had a longer road to rehabilitation than JT did here, who was merely expressing an inclination to believe a police officer. And that sort of circumstance exists in every other case that appellant relies on, and in every other case where the Supreme Court has found that a trial court has abused its discretion in denying a challenge for cause. For example, again, in Pertini, I think it's Pertini, the juror in question knew the lead investigator of the case, said that she was likely to credit him, and was, again, universally equivocal.
So it was a personal relationship.
Personal relationship, not
simply law enforcement.
Right. In Logan, for example, I can't remember if this is the case that appellant relies on, but in Logan, you have a juror that is expressing overall sort of societal concerns about an increase in violent crime and the concern that he was would be unable to sort of set that aside. We don't have that here. It's sort of, again, the more deeply embedded bias from which it's just harder to, through questioning, establish rehabilitation. Here you have a juror that said that, you know, he knows some people in law enforcement, nobody related to this case. He tends to think they have a difficult job. And so the question is, can we bring this person back to be rehabilitated to serve on the jury? And so you don't have that component from those other cases.
In this case, you had two eyewitnesses to what happened in the apartment. You had Grewer and you had Mr. Klund. There was some police investigation, but it seems that the jury would believe one or the other.
I agree with that. I agree with your sort of statement. I would push back a little bit, Your Honor, because your question to me sounds like it tends to go to whether or not this was harmless error. And of course, a biased juror sitting on a jury is structural error.
Right. Yep.
And so while I agree that your observation is correct, I don't think that matters here. Mm-hmm. And the question for the court is whether or not this juror was rehabilitated. That's not the question for the court. The question for the court is whether or not Judge Guthman, to which this court gives great deference, abused its discretion in finding that the juror was rehabilitated. Those are the two points the primary points I wanted to make on the juror issue. On the ineffective assistance of counsel issue, I primarily want to rest on my brief on that claim, but I do want to make one point. And it is a correction in my brief at page 28, about two-thirds of the way down the page. I state accordingly any deficient performance on counsel's part for failing to request the 705 justifiable taking of life instruction was not prejudicial. Of course, I'm wrong. That's I'm referring to the 706 general self-defense instruction there. I apologize for that. This area of law is confusing enough without errors in the brief, so I'm sorry for that.
This is the second case in the month that I've sat on where this has been the issue. The wrong jig has been given.
It's complicated.
On this case.
It is complicated, Your Honor. And I think the testimony of trial counsel, the affidavit of trial counsel, and the circumstances of this case just illustrated how complicated it is. There is no prejudice here as a matter of law. And I think I make that point better in my brief than I can make it here again. But the fact that he was convicted of intentional counts as to each victim eliminates the possibility of prejudice here as a matter of law. This isn't a situation where the court has to dig into the facts to determine whether there was prejudice, as the court would normally have to do to find prejudice, because the case law is quite well established on this point. So unless there are questions on that or on my alternative argument, where you do need to dig into the facts, I'm happy to answer those, but otherwise I would rest on my brief on that issue. And I would thank you for your time and ask that you affirm these convictions. Thank you.
Mr. Butler.
Starting by addressing Judge Riley's factual question, the backpack, page 713, these all come from Mr. Greer's testimony. He identifies a backpack. From a photograph of the scene, he identifies a backpack. He says it looks like his backpack. He says that Ms. Rawls had his backpack at one point and she was around the house. He says it looks like his backpack. He's a little bit evasive about whether it really is or not. At page 715, he acknowledges that it is, quote, possible that Ms. Rawls brought that backpack to Mr. Klun's room. And at page 757, he finally kind of gives in and says, well, yeah, Ms. Rawls had my backpack, and that backpack ended up in Mr. Klun's bedroom.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Just a couple points. Counsel suggests that this juror isn't as biased as other jurors, or is biased for different reasons. And there's no such thing in the law. If a juror expresses actual bias, the juror expresses actual bias. You're either biased or you're not. So if you're biased because you know your aunt is a nurse in the emergency room, or you know one of the law enforcement officers, or whether you believe law enforcement over other witnesses, you're still actually biased. And there's no support in any of the case law that I'm aware of or that the state has cited for the idea that the degree of rehabilitation necessary changes depending on the source of the juror's bias.
No, counsel, that he... I understood respondents' counsel to be arguing that that meant the degree of rehabilitation is different, but rather that, again, going back to our repeated discussion, this is an abuse of discretion standard of review. We are going to defer to the district court's determination on rehabilitation. Isn't that one of the factors that goes into the mix in terms of our deference? We have actual bias expressed in this case. You would like us to look at some of the other case law in saying it was an abuse of discretion, but in those instances, the type of bias was different. I mean, it's a factual thing, right?
I don't know that...
It does impact our analysis.
It is a factual difference. There are lots of factual differences, Your Honor, but I don't think it impacts the analysis at all, and I don't know of any case that holds that...
I guess I'm not trying to suggest it impacts the analysis as in the points that are looked at. Like you said, rehabilitation has to be established. That's required. We have a finding by the judge. We typically defer to those findings.
That's true. Yeah. But that's true in that's also true in Logan, and it was true in Fraga, and it was true in Pertine, and it was true in Reese.
So in all
of those cases, you had findings by the judge that the juror had been rehabilitated, and you don't give absolute deference to that. You have to look at the question and answer and determine whether the judge was right or wrong, whether the judge abused his discretion or not. I'm sorry, Your Honor, did you have another question?
No, I guess the only other question I have for you is which of those cases do you think is closest to this one?
I think Reese is probably closest. Mm-hmm. In Reese, the juror said that she supported law enforcement. Now, in that case, she worked for law enforcement. She was a 911 operator. She wasn't a sworn police officer. But she said she supported law enforcement and would credit their testimony over that of other witnesses. The rehabilitation there wasn't good enough, and the trial judge said, good enough. You know, whatever you said there is good enough for me. And this court said no, and the Supreme Court affirming this court said no. On the single, you know, Judge Bradfield asked counsel about the one unequivocal answer of yes. It is the one unequivocal answer to a non-leading question. It's that one at the very end. And I would suggest that something is out there called, well, if there's a single unequivocal answer, then the district court probably hasn't abused its discretion in seating the juror, Fraga cuts the other way. Because there's also an unequivocal answer in Fraga, and the Supreme Court said, no, you still abused your discretion in seating that juror.
So Judge Guffman in the post-conviction order, this is with regard to the jury instructions.
Certainly.
Said that your client was convicted of intentional murder or attempted murder, and therefore it didn't matter. He wasn't prejudiced by not, even though his defense was, I didn't intend to do it. Mm-hmm. The jury rejected that. And so there was no prejudice to your client because of the incorrect jig being given.
Mm-hmm. That's true. That's what he said.
I know. So, and your response, I don't want to put words in your mouth.
Sure. I have 9 seconds left. Can I give my response?
You certainly may.
Thank you, Your Honor. My response is that that's not true. You have to look at what would have happened had the proper instruction been given. The proper instruction has nothing to do with intent. When a defendant claims he didn't intentionally commit the homicide, and I disagree a little bit that this area of law is very complicated. The Supreme Court has said for 25 years that where the defendant says he didn't intentionally commit the homicide, you don't give the justifiable taking of life instruction. You give the regular self-defense instruction. So you have to imagine a universe in which the defendant says I didn't do it, or says I didn't intend to do it, and the regular self-defense instruction is given, and think about how that jury deliberation would go. Now, the jury there could have found, in that universe, the jury could have found intent to kill, fine. But that's not the ultimate question under a regular self-defense instruction. Under a regular self-defense instruction, the question is, were the defendant's actions reasonable to commit or to prevent the commission of an offense against him, or in this case, to prevent a trespass in his dwelling? That's an entirely different qualitative question than the one that this jury was set to answer. This jury was set to answer only, did Ms. Rawls and Mr. Greer commit a felony? So the fact that the jury found intent doesn't answer at all the question of what they would have found had they properly been given the proper self-defense instruction. And to the extent there are cases stating otherwise, they are plain error cases. They are not ineffective assistance of counsel cases. An ineffective assistance of counsel case involves a serious constitutional error. Mr. Klund was deprived of the counsel afforded to him by the Sixth Amendment of the Constitution. That is a much more serious error. If we're going to talk about severity of errors, like severity of bias, that is a much more serious error than an unobjected to jury instruction on a plain error review where a defendant would have to show a gross miscarriage of justice in order to win. That's not the case here.
Thank you,
Your Honors.
Much.